My name is Srikanth Ajayaraja. I'm from Sri Lanka originally. Currently working at the Institute for Sustainability and Peace at the United Nations University. How many of you know about UNU? May I see if you know, if you have heard? Only one? Two? So, United Nations University is a university within the UN system. It's part of the UN system, like WHO, World Meteorological Organization. It's an institution, but also, if maybe you know, within the UN system, we also have the programs like UNDP, United Nations Development Program, or UNEP, United Nations Environment Program. UNU is not a program, it's an institution, so it's part of the framework of the United Nations. When UNU was established in the early 1970s, the idea was to make an international university where the students could come from many countries and get a degree. But then many other universities said that if United Nations have a university, it is not very fair for other universities. So they decided not to have students. So UNU was mostly a think tank for the UN system. And we had only the people who finished their PhD or master degree and did research at UNU. But about 2 years ago, just 2 years ago, the United Nations Assembly made a change and said that the United Nations University can give degrees. So now the UN system has started to give degrees. Some of our institutions have master programs and some have PhD programs. So if you are interested, you can get more information about the UN system. There is something different in the United Nations University. Usually in a conventional university, we study about different subjects, like maybe mathematics, chemistry, or physics, engineering, and so on. The United Nations system was designed not to study subjects, but to address some problems. So each institute has some focused problems. Some of the earliest institutes, maybe like WIDER in Finland, they look at economics, development economics. What is the relationship between development and economics? We have institutes looking at disasters, but not about how the disasters are made, but how the vulnerability of people make the impacts very severe. So that institute does not study how the disaster happened, but study more about how to make society strong against disasters. So because of this approach, all the institutions in UNU have to be multidisciplinary because they address different problems. So in our universities or institutions, we have faculty from many disciplines, from engineering, social science, and so on. So each institute focuses on their own problems. So our institute, which is located in Tokyo, is called the Institute for Sustainability and Peace. So our mandate is to study or conduct research of why things, some things are sustainable than others. Why some things can become very productive but don't last very long. And then they collapse very quickly. And also there's a very interesting question about sustainability and peace. Some would say that since sustainability includes peace, because maybe you can say without peace there cannot be sustainability. And some would say that peace is very much required to make things sustainable. And also it is interesting to think about what is actually peace. When we ask a question, what is peace? Often we say peace is without war. So this means we cannot really define peace as an action. It is not having a war is peace. Or how can we really make peace without thinking about conflict? So in that sense, we can also think that if we can have a system which is not leading to any conflict, that is a peaceful system. So people always look at how to avoid conflict or how to keep peace in terms of avoiding conflict. So within the UN system also, if you look at, we have UN peacekeeping operations, or UN is conducting negotiations to stop conflicts. But another thing is how can make conditions to stop conflicts. And that is also related to sustainability. And this means how we can use resources in an equitable way so that we will avoid conflict. So, in that sense, our research topic is also rather interesting for this institute. So today, I will talk a little bit about these ancient irrigation systems. I will tell you a little bit about the background of this topic. This institution is rather new. It's established in 2009. But before that, we used to have two programs of the center of the headquarters. One program is called Environment and Sustainable Development, which was mostly looking at natural science perspective on environment. Then we have another program, which is called Peace and Governance, which was looking at how we can maintain peace and the role of good governance in maintaining peace. Now, in 2009, we had the new rector said that we cannot think of these problems separately, we should integrate. And so, these programs were put together. And also we realized that in order to discuss them together, we need to have another dimension related to development, because most of our activities are driven by the need for development, and to link these sustainability and the peace issues, we realize that we need to have this new discipline to connect them. So we have three sections in our program. One is the environment and sustainable development, which is now we call global change and sustainability. Another one for peace and security, and the third one is international cooperation and development. Now, sustainability itself has another important history of development. In Japan, about 7-8 years ago, a new discipline was established called sustainability science. The idea of sustainability science is to see how we can integrate the knowledge we have in many different disciplines. For example, now if you think of any particular activity we do, we study them in detail in different disciplines, but then we don't realize how they affect a different sector or different group. One very good example is the energy issue. So we develop very much, we are very much dependent on the energy, and we won't have cheap energy, so we develop methods to make cheap energy and also make industry. But then we realize that they also affect our environment, leading to climate change, global warming. But it's very difficult to link the energy sector and the environment also. So even after the IPCC4 clarified the linkage and the problems associated with global warming, the world still cannot come to an agreement how to address this issue. So this is mainly coming from this compartmentalized approach. That is, we solve problems in different disciplines. The idea of sustainability science is how to bring these different disciplines together and to look at problems in a more holistic way. And this has been a project, special project, at the University of Tokyo and with a number of universities. And UNU has become a member, and our institution is also mandated to contribute to the thinking of how to implement the sustainable science ideas in development projects. And within our program, we also have a network of universities which is called University Network for Climate and Ecosystem Change Adaptation Research. You can see this is not only climate change, but also ecosystem change. Maybe in this course you are studying quite a bit about biodiversity, the changes of biodiversity, and how it is affecting people's lives. And sometimes these changes could be independent of the climate change. Sometimes they can be because of climate change. And sometimes they are very much linked, the biodiversity issues and the climate change issues. And they all require addressing them at the local level. So therefore, we realize also it's important to combine these our approaches or the way we address these problems together. This is also in line with the sustainable science approach to look at problems holistically. So in this sense, maybe you are familiar with the IPCC process. This is Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is collecting and disseminating information about climate change. Similarly, there will be a new process called IPBES, which will be collecting and disseminating information about biodiversity issues. And at UNU, our director is trying to find ways to link these two processes so that we can address them together. So in this research program, we also try to study about how we can do those things. By the way, during my talk, if you have any questions, please raise hands, so anytime you can interrupt and we can discuss, okay? So within this University Network program, we have an activity that is to develop educational materials and also joint research programs. Currently, we have 19 universities who directly contribute to that, but we also have a number of other very important partners like the Yunnan University who are actively contributing to this research area. One of the projects we have is called How We Can Improve Resilience in the Bioproduction Systems. I will not go to discuss about resilience, but maybe I hope you have some idea of resilience. Have you heard this word, resilience? Yes. So, what is, can anyone tell you resilience? How do you understand? What do we call a resilient system? Normally, if a system can absorb shocks and come back to the original state, we call resilience, right? But that is one aspect of resilience. Another aspect very much related to climate change is related to the phase transition, that the change could be gradual, that it could shift from one phase to another phase completely. So it's not only to absorb shocks, but also to absorb the transition from one phase to another phase. So in this project, what we like to look at is how we can enhance the resilience in the agriculture production systems. Specifically, we want to look at the traditional production systems, which are very resilient against change, and the new production systems, which are very efficient, but may not be very resilient. For example, the modern monocrop agriculture systems could be very much affected by change to climate, or the attacks by pests, or by disease, and they could completely be gone. And also, if you don't get the correct weather patterns, they will not produce anything at all. But on the other hand, we have many traditional agricultural systems in Asia, which have been in operation for many, many hundreds of years. And this means they can absorb the changes. But also we know that their output is not very high. In the sense they are not very efficient. So a lot of people are abandoning these traditional systems to the new system. But we think that we cannot completely neglect the lessons and the experiences And we should find some way how to make use of these very important experiences and the traditional knowledge to be in harmony with the modern system. So in this project we propose that we should look at how to make a kind of mosaic, because you cannot replace one system with the other. To be practical, you cannot say this is good and this is bad. There are good points in one, there are bad points in other. So we can learn from each system. But the question is how we can link them, because in practical sense, different institutions, different stakeholders manage these different systems. And each one would like to promote their own system. So in practical sense, how can we link these two together? In this particular project, what we propose is to have a kind of a mosaic. That means we have the traditional system and the modern system to live side by side, where the strengths of each can be utilized. So if there is a problem with the modern very highly efficient systems, you can still depend on the diversity of the traditional systems to provide you the basic inputs, and then it will provide the resilience to bring or to come back to the natural production system. So this is sort of my introduction to the system, because I think our lecture is, some of you thought it's starting at 9 o'clock, I think now everyone is here at 9 o'clock, so let me go to the background. I would like to talk a little bit about Sri Lanka, because we are talking about these traditional irrigation systems in Sri Lanka. I'll touch on climate, geography and agriculture, and about these ancient irrigation systems, about its evolution and structure of that, and what made them unique, because they were trying to address not only the production of food, but many other things in a very holistic way. And whether we could have any lessons for the modern systems from there. So you can see that India is here. Sri Lanka is an independent island, which is from the south of India. It has a completely different culture and also language from that of India. And the written history is about more than 2,000 years old of the country. And it has a climate which is very tropical. The area is about 65,000 square kilometers. And as you can see here, the rainfall is rather high, which is about 2,000 millimeters per year at some places, but almost going up to about 5,000 millimeters. You can see from this map, the central part has mountains, which can go to about 2,000 meters, and around that is very flat. So this means if we travel from the coastline here, the capital, to the central part, which is about 3-4 hours, we cover many, many different types of ecosystems. The very dry coastal areas to the very cold mountain areas about 4 degrees. And the rainfall comes in two monsoon systems. One is the southwestern monsoon, which is lasting from May to September, and the northeastern monsoon from December to February. This monsoon, which is coming from this side, cannot travel to this up the north central part because of the mountains. So this area receives rainfall from the southwestern monsoon, but this area does not. Whereas the northeastern monsoon covers the whole country. So this means this area receives rainfall twice a year, and this area receives rainfall only once a year. And so because of this rainfall distribution, the climate is different from two parts. This part is dry and this part is wet. So how do you call some areas dry or some areas wet? Do you know what is the rainfall in Yunnan? How many millimeters a year? How much rainfall in that year? No? You don't know actually. Oh. Anybody from Yunnan University?
for millimeters per year. Okay, let's check on that later. In Japan, it's about 1,250 millimeters per year. And also, if you go to Thailand, Thailand also has about the same rainfall, about 1,250 millimeters. If you have traveled to those two countries, you would think Thailand is very dry and Japan is rather wet. That is because the evaporation in Thailand is very high. So even if you get the same rainfall, depending on how much sunshine is removing the water, decides whether it's a wet area or a dry area. Now in Sri Lanka, the country is divided into two zones. This zone, the blue zone, is called wet zone. It receives more than 2,000 millimeters of rainfall. The dry zone is less than 2,000 millimeters of rainfall. So according to, if you go by the standards of Japan, it receives much, much higher rainfall than Japan, but it's called dry zone. The very, very dry zone receives about 1,000 millimeters per year. This is because the evaporation rate is very, very high. So this is very dry. And interestingly, at the very beginning, people lived in dry zone. So you can see, if you look at from a satellite, you can see many black dots. These are the places where people built reservoirs or lakes to collect water. It's interesting that if you look at historically, that the ancient civilization in many places developed in the very dry places. Maybe it's easy to do construction, and maybe it's easy to have the infrastructure in the dry soil. For example, Israel, most of the cities are 4,000 years old or more, and you can see they came up in places where there's water, from groundwater, but are very dry. So at the beginning, people lived here. Then later, they migrated to this more wet zone for due to a number of reasons. But if you look at this dry zone, you can see many, many, many of these small tanks, which actually was used to collect water. So still the main part of agriculture is produced in the dry zone. The rainfall is 1,250 millimeters, but there is a very high variability interannual. Interannual means year to year, the rainfall changes very much.